This is ABC Radio National, The Science Show. And so, to waste, our final stop in this worldwide quest, to the biggest producer of all.
The Forbidden City in central Beijing, home to China's emperors for nearly five centuries, and a reminder in modern times of the country's ancient traditions. In particular, the harmony that once existed between people and nature. Hello, I'm Lynn Malcolm with the final part in our Radio National series, A World Without Waste. The 21st century has already seen a tremendous upsurge in prosperity for China's capital, bringing with it the discord of demolition and construction. But with this frenzied growth, there's a real fear that China has left behind its reverence for the natural world. Beijing, like the rest of the country, lacks any coherent strategy to deal with the waste and pollution that comes with economic success. It wasn't always like this.
We have a long tradition of ecological culture, but during the past 100 years, Chinese people threw it away. So now most people just pursue the money, but you have no the mechanisms to balance our relationship between man and nature.
If we burn all coal and oil, that means that everything is changed. It's no more the nature. And we are just going to kill ourselves. This is my point.
I still remember that when I was a child, when we used the toothpaste tin as the container, and you can sell it for 3 cents. And because the Chinese tradition to saving things, to use things. But now things seem changed. The people do not do this anymore. I think the recycle rate is lower than 20 years ago.
And it was also 20 years ago that a fascinating discovery was made about the history of solid waste management in China since World War II. It was revealed in some research conducted for the World Bank by Dr. Neil Seldman from the US-based Institute for Local Self-Reliance.
We discovered that the most advanced system, which came closer to a zero-waste system than anyone has ever achieved until that point, including today, this system was set up in Shanghai right after the revolution by Chou En-lai using the former street garbage pickers. And they established the Shanghai Resource Recovery Corporation, which at its height had 10,000 employees. Materials were recycled at an enormous rate. That system has fallen apart. And in 1959, Chou En-lai, 10 years after the fact, awarded the workers of this company was called Heroes of the Revolution. Because of their extraordinary work of changing their lives from street beggars to entrepreneurs, very successful entrepreneurs.
Here at the food stalls of the night market in one of the bustling central areas of Beijing, I can buy just about anything to satisfy my hunger. There's snake meat spiraled on a skewer, or just snake skin if I'd prefer, barbecued grasshoppers, chicken hearts, scorpions, and silkworms. I even saw three or four baby seahorses lined up on a kebab stick, ready to throw on the barbie. This is a startling reminder that one of the ancient traditions of Chinese culture is that nothing is wasted. Everything is a potential resource. Over the past 25 years, China has certainly reinforced its tradition of entrepreneurship, with an astounding economic growth rate now around 9% annually. Meanwhile, grave environmental problems are looming. China's air quality, soil contamination, and water pollution are amongst the worst in the world. And solid waste management is just starting to be addressed. Up until 10 years ago, open dump sites literally created a wall around Beijing. According to a recent World Bank report, urban China generated 190 million tonnes of municipal solid waste in 2004. No country has ever experienced such fast growth in waste production. China is now ahead of the United States. the foyer of Beijing's traditional and ornate Friendship Hotel, the venue for RO5, an international scientific gathering focusing on three waste management principles: recovery, recycling and reintegration. It's in Beijing for the very first time at the request of some of China's leading scientists, including Professor Li Jinghai, Vice President of the China Academy of Sciences. Professor Li was keen to focus the Congress on the idea of a recycling economy and how to make it a reality in China.
Recycling economy means that the whole process should be closed. Resources is used again and again. But that is just an idealized concept. In practice, it is very difficult to be realized.
You're saying that you need more cooperation between scientists and political leaders? Is that correct?
Yes, of course. Without scientists, recycling economy is nothing, because 100% recycling is not possible. We should have a balance between environment and the economy. So we must guarantee the input energy consumptions is much less than the recycled resources. That makes sense for recycling economy. And very complicated scientific problems.
Professor Li, Vice President of the China Academy of Sciences. And the fact that half the conference papers were by Chinese scientists shows the country's commitment to tackling this problem. But science alone is not enough, according to Professor Wang Rusong of the Research Centre for Eco-Environmental Sciences in Beijing. He believes that together with recovery, recycling and reintegration, you also need rethinking, reform and refunction.
First is rethinking people's consumption behavior. So this is first rethinking. Second is the institutional problems. We have to reform our industrial production system. Third one is the new recycling economy should pay more attention to its function.
So the last one is really looking at, are you producing the goods that you really need rather than the goods that you think you want?
For example, many young people now buy the private car, even they don't use it.
But naturally, young people want the consumer goods that the rest of the world has. You know, it's very attractive.
Yeah.
It's quite a big ask, isn't it, to ask young people to rethink what they need?
It's time. You see, maybe 20 years ago, if you had been here, then Beijing is a bicycle city. Now it became a car city.
Very much so, I've noticed that.
The car gave, and the bicycle gave it to the private cars. So this is a bad thing. But how to combine this? This is a new challenge. We should not only criticize this, but how to help them to high quality of life as well as the less impact on the environment.
Professor Wang of the China Academy of Sciences. Reaching a better balance between economic prosperity and protection of the environment should be China's top priority, according to Professor Tao Xu of Peking University's College of Environmental Sciences. He says there are two possible scenarios.
If we keep in the current situation, the pollution will get worse, that's for sure, and human health will have a big threat, and I don't know, it would be a terrible situation. Of course, we have other choice. We can reduce the economic development a little bit, maybe 3%. We don't have to keep up the 8-9% increase. We reduce it to 5%. At the same time, we can protect the environment. After a few decades, we're getting better and better.
So you do think it's necessary to pull back economic growth to some extent?
Yeah.
Is that likely to happen?
I don't think so. You can look at this, the local government's reaction to this kind of thing. It's very interesting. For the very early developed cities, you talk to these government officials, they start to recognize the importance of the protection environment, and they spend more money on that. But for the most of the cities, they look at the other fast-developed areas. They thought that they are behind the development, so their focus is on how to develop fast. So it's hard to ask them to slow down.
So you and your colleagues obviously feel very strongly about what needs to happen, but it seems that you're also powerless to really get action. How do you keep hope about the future?
Well, things will change sooner or later. For the environment protection, the public involvement, it will be a key point to get the decision maker to move. And so far, it's not happened. It's very rarely heard this kind of story, public involvement. It's started. A few groups around now. But you can hear the noise, but hardly any effect on the government so far.
The dark has descended in Beijing now, and I'm in a taxi in the midst of maddening traffic. I'm on the way to see Kevin May, the toxics campaigner for Greenpeace, to see what effect he thinks a group like his can have in a country like China.
I guess that China is still learning how to, you know, making use of NGOs' influence to help China to improve. It's a rather new experience for the Chinese government.
But does your group actually officially exist?
No, actually, we registered in Hong Kong, but we're able to hold a series of public activities and also to talk to the media. That's very good for us.
One of their latest campaigns focused on the illegal export and dumping of toxic waste from developed countries to China. Kevin May says the scale of the problem is huge. And because this waste contains toxic substances such as lead, mercury and cadmium, the environmental damage could be devastating. Kevin May has visited one of these electronic dump sites in China. I asked him what it's like.
Shocking, if I may use this word. The first time I went through a very famous electronic waste dumping site is about a year ago. The place is called Guiyu. It's in the southern part of Guangdong province in the mainland China. The first feeling is that the village is full of piercing smell, and you can see piles of electronic waste everywhere. When you explore further, all the rivers have been blackened. The workers are using their bare hands and very simple tools like chisel and hammer to dismantle a lot of electronic waste there. For example, the monitors, which is full of lead, and also the printer circuit boards, which is filled with brominated flame retardants and other hazardous metals there. And this is worrying, because workers do not really understand the kind of risk they're exposing themselves to.
These are illegal dump sites. From what you can see, what is the government doing about this situation?
Actually, the government is also very concerned about the situation. Although we noticed that the government has been trying very hard to stop through various departments' efforts like the customs, but still, because the amount of electronic waste being exported from the West to China is huge. They found it difficult to stop the whole export.
Do you think that some of the big producers of electronic goods take less responsibility in countries like China than, say, they do in more developed countries?
Yes, we do. Some companies already have rather comprehensive, for example, take-back system. In developed countries like Canada, some big names already said that they would not export their products outside Canada for recycling. However, in China, we don't see that take-back system, collection system being established by most big brand names electronics industry. So we find it kind of a double standard. And we believe that given the profits, they can deliver the same responsibility in the mainland China as well.
Kevin May of Greenpeace in Beijing. You're with ABC Radio National, and I'm Lynn Malcolm with our series A World Without Waste. Today I'm in Beijing, host city for the 2008 Olympic Games. Beijing's successful bid for the Games included a commitment to be the Green Olympics. Could this be the impetus for change? I've just arrived at the venue for the main indoor stadium for the Olympic Games. And around me, I think I've counted something like six cranes. It's buzzing with construction. and the pollution is very heavy in the sky today.
My name is Wang Hong.
My name is Mr. Wang Hong from Guao Investments, and I'm the coordinator of the National Indoor Stadium and Olympic Village site.
I can see here in front of me an absolutely huge construction site here, and many, many metres below, I can probably see, look, hundreds of construction workers. I can identify them by their yellow hats. I wonder if you could give me a description of the building that is going to be here.
This will be the competition venue for the gymnastics and handball for the Olympic Games. The overall floor space is about 81,000 square metres with a seating capacity of 18,000 seats. This venue is in two parts. The first is the main competition area, and the second is for warming up exercises. The shape of the building will look something like a flying wing, and vertically, it will look like a traditional Chinese fan.
Can you tell me some of the plans which are meant to follow the environmental guidelines for the building?
This indoor stadium is strictly following the Beijing Olympic Games environmental activity guidelines and also China's existing regulations about the environment. We want to make this an energy-saving venue. For example, we've designed a 100-kilowatt solar electricity system using some facilities on the roof and the walls. We've also designed a rainwater collection system to collect rain from the roof and the surface of the competition venue. And this water will be purified and used for watering the grasses and also for toilet water. And our air conditioning system will be environmentally friendly and won't have negative impacts on air quality. We will also have a heat exchange system.
It amazed me to learn from Wang Hong that construction here began less than 6 months ago. And from what I saw, they must have been working at an incredible pace. The Beijing Organising Committee for the Olympic Games has a very comprehensive set of environmental guidelines, which include energy and water saving, ecological protection, and water and solid waste treatment. I met up with BOCOG's environmental director, Yu Xiaoshun, and asked him how their plans are progressing.
In our bid for the Olympic Games, we have proposed a very big plan for environmental protection. One of the main objectives is to make sure environmental issues in Beijing are addressed very quickly. It's been 3 years since the successful bid for the 2008 Games. At present, all the work is on schedule, and we are confident our objectives can be realised. However, we acknowledge that this plan is just a part of Beijing's long-term environmental improvement plan, which could take 20 or 30 years. Our current efforts can only accelerate this process, but we cannot expect that after the Olympic Games, all the environmental problems will be resolved in just 6 or 7 years. Even though we may develop very fast, as we have done with our Chinese economy, we will still have a long way to go to reach the standards of developed countries.
Yu Xiaoshun of the Beijing Organising Committee of the Olympic Games. And it'll be interesting to see what sort of environmental kickstart the Olympics can give to Beijing. Not everyone's convinced, for example, that their efforts in the area of solar energy have gone far enough. But renewable energy is certainly gaining a profile in China.
Renewable energy will play an important role in China's energy strategy. Next January, the renewable energy law will come into effect, and the government plans to lift renewable energy consumption to 10% of the total energy consumption in China by 2020.
Renewable energy is at the heart of the zero waste concept, according to Professor Ma Shenghong, the director of the Centre for Renewable Energy. He believes that waste occurs when you fundamentally change naturally occurring material. And when it's put in the wrong place, you disrupt the natural cycle.
Why renewable is good? Because you don't change the material essentially. But if you burn coal, you essentially change the material. The people always say the coal and the oil could be used for 200 or 300 years. But they forgot one thing. if we burn all coal and oil, that means that everything is changed.
It's gone.
It's no more, no more the nature. And we are just going to kill ourselves. This is my point. So dangerous.
China is fast becoming a world leader in the development and use of renewable energy. It's in rural China where renewable energy is set to have an enormous impact, helping to connect around 30 million people to the country's electricity grid. So far, the Chinese government has provided power to over 1,000 townships with a combination of photovoltaic batteries and small hydropower systems. Within 10 years, this will be the most significant rural renewable energy project in the world. Professor Ma Sheng Hong has been instrumental in this Send Power to Townships project, giving people the basic conveniences of light, refrigeration and television for the very first time.
I think this is a very, very important issue in China, not only for the renewable energy, but also for the social development of China. You see, China still has a big portion of the people living in the countryside. And actually, these people, the energy consumption is far less than people in the city. And the Chinese government has already made a strategic decision to improve the living standard of Chinese people. We just think, if all the rural people consume electricity from the present level, 50 to 100 kilowatt hour, up to present citizen living standard, what is the requirement for the resource, for the infrastructure? Would this be possible or sustainable for China? I don't think so. We have to think about the future of the Chinese people living. We cannot afford all city becomes Beijing. That's not possible. That's not the way. So a decentralized system would be the future for Chinese people. So for the rural sector, for the countryside, renewable energy is not only the energy issue, it's also social development and a political issue. Because we cannot make a deviation of the people living standard to distance, yeah? That's dangerous.
Professor Ma Sheng Hong from the China Academy of Sciences. Oh my God, the smell. We've just had a grueling two-hour taxi ride northeast of Beijing, out past the airport. And we've just arrived at the Shunyi biogas plant. It's part of a large pig farm and it slaughters 60,000 pigs a year. I was just about knocked out by the odour. I've never smelled anything like it before in my life. I guess that's what happens when you produce 600 tonnes of manure a day. This pig farm is home to up to 30,000 pigs and all that waste needs to be treated before it's discharged to reduce its organic content to meet Beijing's wastewater discharge standards. The biogas plant here not only deals with this effluent, but has real potential as an energy source. William Wallace is the technical advisor for this renewable energy project, set up jointly by the United Nations Development Project and the Global Environment Facility.
So you see these trenches, it's just gravity feed. Liquid waste flows down into a collection tank.
All right, so we actually have the pig manure here with water flowing through it. The smell is just about unbearable.
This is a fine wire mesh screen and the liquid flows through it and the solid is separated, taken to another location for composting.
All right, let's get out of here.
Since in China there's a considerable market for a dry processed fertilizer, the solid is then composted and sold at local farms around this site as a fertilizer. The liquid then is pre-treated and then fed into these two large tanks that you see. Each one of these tanks is about 1,200 cubic meters. These are upflow anaerobic sludge bed reactors. It is without oxygen. It's a special type of reactor that is high efficiency in the treatment of this organic effluent. The main product from this process is methane. The gas that actually comes out of these reactors is about 60% methane. That's combined with other inert gases. That methane is subsequently stored, and at the moment at this farm, it's burned in a boiler, and they use the heat from the boiler for various processes around the farm. However, in the future, they will be generating electricity. The daily production of biogas at the farm is about 2,200 cubic meters per day. If they used all of that gas to produce electricity, they could produce about 3,500 kilowatt hours per day. That's enough to run the electrical requirements of the process itself, plus some extra electricity to run other farm operations.
William Wallace believes that renewable energy will provide not only a significant power source for China, but also an important international investment opportunity. And it's this attitude which continues to drive the country along the road towards greater economic development, which began nearly three decades ago.
I believe it was 1979 when Deng Xiaoping made the famous statement about the cats. It doesn't matter what color the cat is, white or black, as long as he catches the mouse. And that's one starting point for the opening of China, the beginning of the special economic zones where industrial experimentation took place in China. And from that point on, it's been a steady road forward and upward.
William Wallace. China still has a long way to travel to catch up with the West's environmental management standards. But is it too late for China? Neil Seldman.
Of course not. Of course not. If it's not too late for the United States, it's not too late for China. But it is too late for both societies and for both economies if they don't listen to their citizens and if they don't listen to common sense. Because the burn and bury paradigm has been with us for generations and it has to be changed. I would imagine it's easier to change here because of the command and control that the administration has. In the United States, it took 20 years of grassroots organizing. I think it could happen much quicker in China. We have to wait and see.
It's peak hour in Beijing, and the sunset is strangely beautiful through the heavy pollution. But the sickening traffic jams and fog-like atmosphere is a constant reminder of the enormous environmental challenges for this country, hanging like grey clouds over the horizon. Yet China's astounding entrepreneurship and its commitment to science over the last 20 years could be a hopeful indication that the country is capable of catching up in time to strike the crucial balance between wealth and the natural world. Perhaps they can avoid the mistakes other countries have made and get closer to a world without waste.
The key is the people's behaviour, their culture. If we can reach ecological awareness, I think we are hopeful. And it will be success.
As a scientist, if we have technology, I hope we could make great contribution. That is our duty, not only for the country, but also for the world.
Wang Rusong and Li Jinghai. Our series, A World Without Waste, was a co-production between ABC Radio National and the BBC World Service. For more, visit our website at abc.net.au/rn and click on the link to A World Without Waste. The series producer was Ramid Sabar, with sound engineers Stephen Tilley and Louis Mitchell. And I'm Lynn Malcolm.
And Lynn Malcolm presents All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. Next week, the Science Show turns to Neanderthals. Did they invent music? I'm Robin Williams.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.